The audiobook review this week is The Aspen Papers. The audiobook has been supplied by our friends at Caliber, and special thanks go to Naxos Publishing for the kind permission to use the excerpts from the recording with their narrator, Matthew Gill. Henry James was born in New York City into a wealthy, intellectually inclined family. His father, Henry James Sr., was interested in various religious and literary pursuits. In his youth, James travelled with the family back and forth between Europe and the United States. He studied with tutors in Geneva, London, and Paris and Bonn. At the age of 19, he briefly and unsuccessfully attended Harvard University Law School, but he much preferred reading and writing fiction to studying law. From an early age, James read, criticised, and learned from the classics of English, American, French, Italian, German, and in translation, Russian literature. In 1864, he anonymously published his first short story, A Tragedy of Error, and from then on devoted himself completely to literature. For much of his life, James was an expatriate living in Europe. Much of The Portrait of a Lady was written while he lived in Venice, a city whose beauty he found distracting. So he was better pleased with the small town of Rye in England. This feeling of being an American in Europe came through as a reoccurring theme in his books, which contrasted American innocence, or lack of sophistication, with European sophistication, or decadence. As described in his major novels, The Portrait of a Lady, The Ambassadors, and The Golden Ball. Throughout his career, he contributed extensively to magazines such as The Nation, The Atlantic Monthly, Harper's and Scribner's. And from 1875 to his death, he maintained a strenuous schedule of book publications in a variety of genres, including novels, short stories, literary criticism, travel writing, biography, and autobiography. Henry James died in 1916, aged 72. So we are back in the studio, and I have Debbie with me. And this week we are reviewing The Aspen Papers by Henry James. And I was just saying earlier, I'm ashamed to say I've never read any Henry James, and that's very remiss of me.
Well, the one that springs to my mind is The Turn of the Screw, which I've read a few times, really, really like. But I confess I know very little about him.
He spent a lot of time in Europe and then ended up in the UK. But a very renowned writer and prolific. 30 novels, travel writing, essays. Yeah. And The Aspen Papers falls sort of mid-career. It's a novella. It's an interesting book, isn't it? Yes. Did you enjoy it?
Oh, very much. And it makes me think there should be more novellas. Yes, it's a short book, but it's exactly the right length for this story. And I think so often, old and new books are longer than they need to be because the publishers want them to be a certain number of words. And sometimes stories go off on a tangent or the character development goes a bit wonky somehow. And I think this is a real masterclass, actually. I think it's very well structured and I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, as the audio book, it's just under 4 hours, isn't it? Which is great. Yeah, like I say, perfect length. Mm. You really got to know the three main characters in it. Mm-hmm. Because it concentrates around these three characters and in one location, it's set in Venice. And it's narrated by an unnamed narrator. He's not actually named, apart from his false name, which is interesting because the whole story is told from his perspective.
I mean, often if something is written from the point of view of the narrator, he's more, or she is more of a cipher, you know, things happen to them. But I felt I did get a sense of this person's character.
Very much so, yes. The brief outline of the book, without giving too much away, is that there's a couple, an aunt and her niece, Juliana Devereux and Tita Devereux. Juliana and Tita Devereux live in a palazzo in Venice. Juliana is the former girlfriend of Geoffrey Aspen, who's this famous fictitious poet. And the narrator travels out to Venice to try and get hold of some papers, some love letters or poems that the poet had written to Juliana when she was young. So he arrives in Venice and tries to inveigle his way into their world, doesn't he? And he does so by nefarious means, and he's quite dishonest.
He is, isn't he?
He arrives at the palazzo, which is crumbling and somewhat in need of a lot of repair.
It's in a terrible state. And they're living in two rooms, really, and they're not enjoying the beautiful garden. And
that's his way in, isn't it? That's how he says, I've seen your beautiful garden. I would love to come in and present you with flowers every day. And he manages to get himself essentially a lodger, isn't he?
Yes.
And the story evolves from there. And Giuliana's now quite elderly and quite decrepit. And the niece, Tita, is...
She's not young either. They don't say how old she is,
no,
do they?
No, don't. But he does describe her as, middle-aged, dowdy, spinsterish, doesn't he?
With dirty hands.
Yes.
That bit... I'd forgotten. I'd read this a long time ago. And when I read that line, it just jumped out at me. That was a line that had stuck with me for a long time. It was a very unexpected little throwaway, wasn't it?
Yes. And his description of her is not very flattering. Let's just pause there to take an excerpt from the book where the narrator describes his first encounter with Miss Tita.
I may add that by the time the door opened again, through which the maidservant had escaped, my eyes had grown used to the want of light. I had not meant, by my private ejaculation, that I must myself cultivate the soil of the tangled enclosure which lay beneath the windows, but the lady who came toward me from the distance over the hard shining floor might have supposed as much from the way in which, as I went rapidly to meet her, I exclaimed, taking care to speak Italian, the garden, do me the pleasure to tell me if it's yours. She stopped short, looking at me with wonder. And then? Nothing here is mine, she answered in English, coldly and sadly. Oh, you're English. How delightful, I remarked, ingenuously. But surely the garden belongs to the house. Yes, but the house doesn't belong to me. She was a long, lean, pale person, habited apparently in a dull-colored dressing gown, and she spoke with a kind of mild literalness. She did not ask me to sit down, any more than years before, if she were the niece, she had asked Mrs. Prest, and we stood face to face in the empty, pompous hall. Well then, would you kindly tell me to whom I must address myself? I'm afraid you'll think me odiously intrusive, but you know I must have a garden. Upon my honor, I must. Her face was not young, but it was simple. It was not fresh, but it was mild. She had large eyes, which were not bright, and a great deal of hair, which was not dressed, and long, fine hands, which were, possibly, not clean. She clasped these members almost convulsively as, with a confused, alarmed look, she broke out, "Oh, don't take it away from us. We like it ourselves." "You have the use of it, then?" "Oh, yes. If it wasn't for that." And she gave a shy, melancholy smile. "Isn't it a luxury, precisely? That's why, intending to be in Venice some weeks, possibly all summer, and having some literary work, some reading and writing to do, so that I must be quiet, and yet, if possible, a great deal in the open air, that's why I have felt that a garden is really indispensable. I appeal to your own experience," I went on, smiling. "Now, can't I look at yours?"
And yet he does... come to enjoy her company, and she certainly enjoys his, and very early on it's very clear that she's falling in love with him.
Yes, I mean, he does go on a charm offensive, because obviously he sees the way of getting hold of these papers through the niece rather than the elder lady, who tends to be quite reticent and quite clever in a way, because she, as a lodger, she charges him way above what the going rate is. He's paying three times, I think, what he should be paying. And, yeah, the story is basically a three-parter involving these three characters. And it gets quite involved, doesn't it?
Yes.
We should talk about, did these papers exist? And in truth, you know, we don't know if they were real in the first place. Everyone seems to be trying to fool each other, don't they? And is that okay to take private letters? You know, what's the moral?
Let's start with the idea of deception. Because we say the narrator does go in pretending to be, I think he's pretending to be somebody who's just visiting Venice. He's a traveller and he does write a little bit. But he doesn't present himself as he is, as the publisher of Geoffrey Aspin's work. So immediately there's deception there. And what it reminded me of, and I think there's a parallel here, is in recent history, especially with tabloids and The Sun and The Mirror, and they would do absolutely anything to get a story.
Definitely.
They would deceive, they would pay people. But the methods that their journalists use to get information about celebrities and the royals and all sorts of things were absolutely horrific. And that was going through my mind when I was listening to this book, that this narrator will do anything to get hold of these papers, including pretending to be somebody else, pretending to sort of flirt with the niece. And he's there, and basically to get these papers by any means whatsoever, even if it means stealing them. Shall we pause there to take an excerpt from the audiobook?
Miss Tita looked as if she failed to grasp this rather complicated proposition, so I continued, "If you have not told her what I said to you the other night, may she not at least have guessed it?" "I don't know. She is very suspicious."
"But she has not been made so by indiscreet curiosity, by persecution."
"No, no, it isn't that," said Miss Tita, turning on me a somewhat troubled face. "I don't know how to say it. It's on account of something, ages ago, before I was born, in her life."
"Something? What sort of thing?" I asked, as if I myself could have no idea.
"Oh, she has never told me,"
Miss Tita answered. And I was sure she was speaking the truth. Her extreme limpidity was almost provoking, and I felt for the moment that she would have been more satisfactory if she'd been less ingenuous. "Do you suppose it's something to which Geoffrey Aspern's letters and papers, I mean the things in her possession, have reference?"
"I dare say it is," my companion exclaimed, as if this were a very happy suggestion. "I have never looked at any of those things."
"None of them? Then how do you know what they are?"
"I don't," said Miss Tita placidly. "I have never had them in my hands, but I have seen them when she has had them out."
"Does she have them out often?"
"Not now, but she used to. She's very fond of them."
"In spite of their being compromising?"
"Compromising?"
Miss Tita repeated, as if she was ignorant of the meaning of the word. I felt almost as one who corrupts the innocence of youth. "I mean they're containing painful memories."
"Oh, I don't think they are painful."
"You mean you don't think they affect her reputation?"
At this, a singular look came into the face of Miss Bordereau's niece, a kind of confession of helplessness, an appeal to me to deal fairly, generously with her.
I had brought her to the piazza, placed her among charming influences, paid her an attention she appreciated, and now I seem to let her perceive that all this had been a bribe.
But I think all the time, these three characters are trying to stay one step ahead of each other. And even Miss Tita is trying to play the aunt a bit, isn't she? And, you know, for what? Does he want it for money? Does he want it because he's got the bit between his teeth and he wants to finish that research? And I understand his motivations, I suppose, but I wouldn't go about doing it in that way.
Yeah, it's a three-way, and it keeps going between the different characters. We think that the elder lady's onto him. It's clear that even though it's not from the narrator's point of view, we can see that she's onto him. In this excerpt, Juliana seems to cast some doubt over the narrator. Let's have a quick listen.
"The old woman was sitting in the same place in which I had seen her last, in the same position, with the same mystifying bandage over her eyes. Her welcome was to turn her almost invisible face to me and show me that, while she sat silent, she saw me clearly. I made no motion to shake hands with her. I felt too well on this occasion that that was out of place forever. It had been sufficiently enjoined upon me that she was too sacred for that sort of reciprocity, too venerable to touch. There was something so grim in her aspect, it was partly the accident of her green shade, as I stood there to be measured, that I ceased on the spot to feel any doubt as to her knowing my secret, though I did not in the least suspect that Miss Tita had not just spoken the truth. She had not betrayed me, but the old woman's brooding instinct had served her. She had turned me over and over in the long, still hours, and she had guessed. The worst of it was that she looked terribly like an old woman who, at a pinch, would burn her papers." Miss Tita pushed a chair forward, saying to me, "This will be a good place for you to sit." As I took possession of it, I asked after Miss Bordereau's health. expressed the hope that in spite of the very hot weather, it was satisfactory. She replied that it was good enough, that it was a great thing to be alive. "Oh, as to that, it depends upon what you compare it with," I exclaimed, laughing.
"I don't compare. I don't compare. If I did that, I should have given everything up long ago."
I like to think that this was a subtle allusion to the rapture she had known in the society of Geoffrey Aspern, though it was true that such an allusion would have accorded ill with the wish I imputed to her to keep him buried in her soul. What it accorded with was my constant conviction that no human being had ever had a more delightful social gift than his, and what it seemed to convey was that nothing in the world was worth speaking of if one pretended to speak of that. But one did not. Miss Tita sat down beside her aunt, looking as if she had reason to believe some very remarkable conversation would come off between us.
"It's about the beautiful flowers," said the old lady. "You sent us so many. I ought to have thanked you for them before. But I don't write letters, and I receive only at long intervals."
She had not thanked me while the flowers continued to come, but she departed from her custom so far as to send for me as soon as she began to fear that they would not come any more. I noted this. I remembered what an acquisitive propensity she had shown when it was a question of extracting gold from me, and I privately rejoiced at the happy thought I had had in suspending my tribute. She had missed it, and she was willing to make a concession to bring it back. At the first sign of this concession, I could only go to meet her.
Miss Tita, who's piggy in the middle, is playing them both, trying to sort of be very friendly with her aunt, and but also trying to ingratiate herself with the narrator.
Yeah.
It's a story of morals, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
And how far would you go to get what you want? And the ending's brilliant, and I can't possibly say what the ending is, because if you're going to listen to this, you really do need to wait till then. So, our three reasons for recommending this novella, this audio novella.
Okay, well, it's primarily a compelling story. You will get through this book very, very quickly. The length of the book is also very attractive, and that, combined with its compelling nature, means it's going to zip by. And lastly, I think it's a really interesting use of the narrator, where, as we've said, so many of the books we've explored before, the narrator isn't a fully fledged character, but I do feel this one is.
That's a really good point, because I think the last two novels that we listened to, the narrators were a bit weak, weren't they? This one really makes up for it, I think. I agree with that.
And sometimes that's okay. Sometimes that is the author's idea and the narrator is a device. So thinking about Nick in Dance to the Music of Time, for instance, that's where it works really well. I think this is just perfect. It's just the right amount of information.
The narrator drives the narrative in this, as they should. I think so as well. You're sort of carried along with him, but then you start to have doubts about him, which is really, really clever. And they're just planted here and there, little seeds of doubt. And as it progresses, those doubts become bigger and without giving away again the ending. I really liked that. I love the language. As I say, it's my first time reading Henry James, and I thought it was very rich with imagery. There's some really great metaphors in it. The crumbling Venice, Giuliana being also of a certain age. There was a lot of symmetry there. I like that element of it. The language was great. And we seem to be favouring short books. But sometimes reading a sort of series of short novels is actually more satisfying than reading a really long...
Because you're not shortchanged on story with this one, are you? Or the overall impact?
Absolutely not. And it packs a punch for a short novella. And I was gripped the whole way through. Mm. I kept wanting to listen and listen and listen. I think I read it in four dog walks. So read it, listened to it in four dog walks, because I really wanted to know what happened at the end. And as I say, the ending's fantastic. So do get a copy of this and listen to it if you can. Thank you, Debbie. Thank you as ever.
You're most welcome.